From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we review the lightning-fast actions of lame duck in Lansing. What's ahead?
This governor has a childlike faith that business will create jobs if given the right conditions. If by 2014 there's no real evidence of that, he may pay a price.
Plus, what if they don't reach a fiscal cliff agreement in Washington?
You know, when they talk about a recession, and most economists think that if, you know, we don't reach some sort of agreement, maybe March, April, that's definitely recession territory.
And we look back at Michigan's big role in the Underground Railroad.
It's estimated that fully half or more of all blacks that end up in Canada before the Civil War come through the Detroit River corridor.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we'll talk with Michigan Congressman Dan Beneschick. He's a Republican calling for cuts to the nation's defense spending. We'll ask why. And as negotiations over the fiscal cliff continue, we'll look at what Michigan businesses are keeping an eye on in D.C. But first, let's turn to the state capitol where the lame duck legislative session is roaring to a close. Right to Work and the thousands of demonstrators who packed the state capitol this week certainly made headlines. But there are many other important issues that have been moving through the chambers as well. Dealing with abortion, a new emergency manager law, changes to the state's personal property tax helping businesses at the expense of local governments, just to name a few. Joining us now are two longtime Michigan political watchers. Bill Ballinger is the editor of Inside Michigan Politics, and Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. Bill, I'd like to start with you, and I want to ask a question that I've been putting to reporters in Lansing all week. Can you remember another time where we saw such a fast-moving, jam-packed lame duck?
Well, in 1996, we had something like this when the Democrats had just regained control of the state house in the November election that year, and Republicans still had control. But nothing of this volume, I think, flowed through the legislature at that time. This is rare, but it's not totally unprecedented.
Jack, give us your sense as to why this all came together, this torrent, in such a short period of time. What made this all happen?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One is that the legislature will be marginally more Democratic next time. It may be harder. It certainly would have been harder or impossible to pass Right to Work. Also, some of the people who are voting were not only people who were defeated, but people who aren't coming back. They might feel they had a freer hand. And I also wonder if some things were jammed up just because it was a campaign year. The legislature spent a lot of time campaigning and in recess, and some of the stuff that might have gotten done earlier didn't get done.
Jack's got it just about exactly right. The thing that I think people have to remember is that legislators have been working on a lot of these bills for like a year and a half. It's not like all of a sudden they just woke up like Rip Van Winkle last week and found all this unfinished business on their calendar or in their committee dockets. They've been working on this, and they had the calendar just loaded. And so a lot of this stuff is being voted on. The public and the news media focus all the time when they talk about how hard a legislature is working on roll call votes, pushing buttons, green lights, red lights on the House and Senate floor. Actually, that's a pretty small percentage of the total amount of work that a legislator does in Lansing. So a lot went into what's happening right now. But, you know, we're right, I think, today, the three of us, in focusing on the fact that it's all come to a head at once, and that's what makes it look like this is just beyond belief.
Do you feel that this comes down to maybe one or two individuals, or is it a group? I mean, we certainly know it's a Republican-controlled legislature, and the governor is a Republican, but what about individuals? I certainly see House Speaker Jace Bulger front and center in much of this. Who else do you think's been involved?
Well, I think all of them were, and I think, you know, Right to Work has dominated the headlines in the last week or so. And I think the fact that the governor finally came out with a statement saying, okay, it is on my agenda, and I will sign it, that kind of broke a logjam on a lot of other stuff, because frankly, I think the governor realized if he didn't give the go sign on that, maybe a lot of other stuff in there, like personal property tax and other things that he really wanted, weren't going to happen. He realized he needed the Republican majority votes more than he needed Democratic support. I mean, there's hardly anything happening with bipartisan support. Everything is heavily partisan, and it's tilted, as Jack pointed out, totally in the Republicans' favor. They have got, remember this, their biggest majority in the state house since right after World War II. And they're about ready to go down to 59-51 beginning in January, and that's a lot different.
Well, again, I hate to agree with Bill, but I do. I think the governor would not have gotten his Metropolitan Detroit transportation package passed if he had not come out for right to work.
Let's talk more about the governor, and there certainly was so much attention paid on the fact that he spent the last 2+ years saying right to work is not in my agenda, it's too divisive, and some of these other issues such as abortion that is now being dealt with, too divisive. So he has changed. Do you think Rick Snyder is leading, or is he being led?
Well, this kind of sounds like, you know, maybe President Obama leading from behind. I think Jack and I have kind of put our finger on it. I mean, I think the governor, in my view anyway, has never been unalterably opposed to right to work. He simply said it's not on my agenda because I think he's a very practical guy, and he realized this thing was going to be extremely controversial and divisive, and if it came up early in the session or in the middle of it, it would get in the way of a whole bunch of other stuff, and he didn't want that to happen. And he just held out until the bitter end, and then I think a number of forces and factors impelled him to make the statement supporting right to work that he did earlier in the week, and you know, everything flowed from that. I think Jack is right. I don't think you would have gotten the mass transit package if it wasn't for the right to work vote.
And Jack, that same question to you, is the governor being led or is he being a leader?
Well, it's kind of a chicken and egg question to some extent on some issues. Certainly on the transportation package, he was the leader. Certainly on the bridge, where he bypassed the legislature. But I think some of us are going to be very curious to see what the governor does with these abortion bills. There's two bills, I think, still in the legislature, and there's two parts of bills having to do with Blue Cross. A lot of folks have believed or have wanted to believe that the governor he might be a fiscal conservative, but was moderate on social issues.
Right.
And we'll have a chance to see just how moderate he is, certainly about the abortion issue.
Do you think now that this has all been playing out in the last week or two, should Governor Snyder distance himself from that far right wing of his party?
Well, in terms of his reelection prospects, he should try to at least present the image that he's still somewhat standoffish about the right wing in his own party, and he's more of a moderate person. But I've got to say that every time he's had an opportunity to veto social, cultural, conservative issues, he hasn't done it. I think he'll sign these abortion bills.
Jack?
I think he probably will. I think there was the one issue where he parted company on a voting issue with the Secretary of State, but other than that, on the motorcycle helmet issue, for example. But he knows, he has to know, that Republicans are no longer competitive in Michigan in presidential elections. They haven't been competitive in Senate elections, with one exception, in 40 years. And if he comes across as a hard right guy, it's going to be a much harder path to re-election, assuming he runs for re-election, than it will be if he's seen as a moderate. So I think that he would like to get this stuff done early. And again, we remember that John Engler did some very unpleasant things early, controversial things, I should say, early in his administration. By the time 1994 rolled around, they've been mostly forgotten.
There seemed to be a lot of anger on the part of voters, not even so much with the final product, but the process, that people felt the bills were jammed through. There was little to no chance for public comment or debate, although, as you point out, there has been work going on for months. But I think the real attention focus seems to people felt that there wasn't a chance to speak out. What message do you think this whole last week of lame duck sends to the people of Michigan?
Well, you know, nothing is going to satisfy the opponents of right to work and some of the other legislations going through. You could have hearings and committee meetings and debates on the House and Senate floor. and they'd still be angry and they'd still oppose the legislation. And the majority, in this case the Republicans, realized the longer it would be dragged out, the more difficult it would be to pass it. And so this is what you do. If you're in the majority and you've got some hot potatoes you want to dispense with, and you've got a lame duck session and time running out and you're going to lose membership as of New Year's Eve, you got to get it done and get it done fast. And, you know, Jack just mentioned short memories. The public does have short memories. It's just hard to believe that Rick Snyder is going to be elected or reelected in 2014 based on the fact that the legislature moved too quickly 2 years before in a lame duck session on bills. It just, you know, defies logic.
Jack Lesenberry, your thoughts?
Well, I think it was Mark Twain who said that legislation like sausage is something you shouldn't watch being made. I think that there may well be some residual bitterness over right to work. We'll see how this all plays out. This governor has a childlike faith that business will create jobs if given the right conditions. If by 2014 there's no real evidence of that, he may pay a price. But no one is going to remember how this stuff was shoved through, nobody other than reporters and other legislators, by 2014, I'm afraid.
Jack Lesenberry is the political analyst for Michigan Radio, and Bill Ballinger is editor of Inside Michigan Politics. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Cynthia.
My pleasure.
And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about Michigan's lawmakers and the recent bills that have been passed in Lansing? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Go to Twitter at Stateside Radio or on the website, michiganradio.org. And I want to remind you about a special event Michigan Radio and Stateside are hosting. Tomorrow morning, I hope you'll join me for coffee and conversation. I'd love to meet you and hear about the stories that you want told on Stateside. We'll all be here at Michigan Radio, at the studios, tomorrow morning from 7:30 to 9 here in Ann Arbor. More information is on the events page of our website, michiganradio.org. Still to come, it's been estimated half, even more, of all African Americans who ended up in Canada before the Civil War came through the Detroit River Corridor. In 15 minutes, we'll look back at Michigan's crucial role in the Underground Railroad. This is Michigan Radio, and you're listening to Stateside. Before the break, we were talking about the lame duck legislative session, and one of the issues we touched on was the measure to overhaul Blue Cross Blue Shield, changing it from a charity to a tax-paying business. Now, considering some 2 out of 3 Michiganders have Blue Cross, this touches lots of us. Peter Luke, writing for Bridge Magazine, has been keeping a close eye on this legislation, and he joins us now. Hi, Peter.
Oh, hello, Cynthia.
So, Peter, help us understand, just for the nuts and bolts of this, how does Blue Cross Blue Shield really fit into the state healthcare picture?
Well, they're the dominant. I mean, they've got 70% market share, and in some forms of business, critical to this legislation, that they've got 100% almost. Mm-hmm. So they're obviously a big player. Most of their role is in administrative capacity, administering self-insured plans, like for the auto companies and so on. I mean, for 70 years, they've been a benevolent trust established by the state of Michigan to be the insurer of last resort. And that was codified in 1980. And what this law does, it turns them into a nonprofit mutual. So they're no longer owned by the people of Michigan, per se. They are owned by the policyholders.
Okay. And what is the purpose of the reform legislation? Take us right down to kind of the ABCs of it.
Well, Blue Cross argued that under the Affordable Care Act, they required consistent regulation with other insurers at the state level to participate in the exchanges that will be set up, in Michigan's case, through the federal government beginning next year. And they said the regulatory framework for putting those policies onto the exchange was too cumbersome. And so right now, it's basically a fairly rigorous rate review process. And that allows for public intervention, intervention by the Attorney General, and intervention by civil service staff at the Office of Financial Regulation and Insurance. And so Under this, it becomes basically a file-and-use system used by other commercial insurance carriers, auto, other health care insurers, life insurers, where they file a rate, and unless the commissioner disapproves, it goes into effect after 60 days.
So the Blues are saying this levels the playing field in the insurance market in the wake of the Affordable Care Act.
Correct.
Critics are worried that the more Blue Cross Blue Shield controls the market, the more it can set prices and practices of docs and emergency rooms and hospitals, and that it won't be under the same strict state scrutiny and oversight that it now has. What are your thoughts on those fears?
Well, you know, anytime you deregulate a monopoly, you know, the tendency is that the monopoly to enjoy that regulatory freedom. In what way they'll do that is unclear. There are some, there is a framework of price restraint built into the ACA in that insurers have to spend at least 80% of their revenue on care. Blue Cross, as a nonprofit, more than meets that right now. The big area of concern is with Medigap policies. 200,000 seniors in the state use it to supplement their Medicare coverage. They can apply for it anytime, and it's heavily subsidized. It's $122 a month on average.
Okay.
And rates will continue to be frozen through 2016 per a 2011 agreement with the Attorney General. After that, there's a question as to whether or not Blue Cross will even be offering Medigap policies. The old law, regulatory law, PA 350, required them to do that and set up the framework for the subsidy. The law is pretty fuzzy on that, and the key word in the new law is may. They may offer those policies. Now, Blue Cross considers Medigap to be inferior to its other main senior policy, which is Medicare Advantage, which is a more holistic policy that involves a lot of different coverages, dental, vision, preventative care, along with their standard Medicare policies. Bill Schuette warns that seniors are facing a cliff in 2016 where either the policies won't be available or rates will go up rather quickly by 66% or so.
Are there any options for seniors other than the Medigap?
Well, Blue Cross will argue going forward a lot. You'll probably see it on TV a lot, is Medicare Advantage, which is it's a type of form of policy set up early on in the Bush administration that allows for individual insurers to offer kind of broader coverage packages outside of, you know, straight basic Medicare. So they'll have those options. Now, senior advocates argue that those Medicare Advantage policies come with higher deductibles and copays and general higher out-of-pocket costs and maybe less portable than Medigap policies, which are actually, you know, Medigap is pretty good insurance. And because it's so heavily subsidized, however, and that subsidy only applies to Blue Cross, that requirement, Blue Cross has pretty much 100% of the market. And that's not a good position for an insurer to be in. So they have a point there.
Peter, who's behind the legislation?
Blue Cross Blue Shield. You know, they came into the governor's office and said, listen, you know, we need to compete on these Affordable Care Act exchanges. We need regulatory relief.
Do they have a point, in your opinion, from what you studied?
Yeah, they do. The question is, you know, a level playing field is important going forward with these exchanges. The question is, what kind of, you can go in two directions. You can bring Blue Cross down to the regulatory level of their competitors, or you can bring their competitors maybe not all the way up to where Blue Cross is right now, but somewhere in the middle. And that's what consumer advocates argued, is that, you know, it was really important to retain some ability by the Attorney General, by the public, to intervene in a rate request and slow it down and at least have public hearings and require the insurer, whoever it is, to publicly justify the rate increase they're asking for. Unfortunately, the bill doesn't include those kinds of provisions.
Bottom line, Peter Luke, it's clear it's a good thing for the Blue Cross Blue Shield side. Is it at all a good? Is this reform at all a good thing for Michigan patients and providers?
Providers actually get some relief. It's really complicated, but Blue Cross used its market dominance to extract some concessions from providers that other insurers and the providers themselves felt were unfair or unwarranted. That clears some of that up. You know, I think the whole healthcare landscape is going to change going forward for a number of reasons. Obviously, you have the Affordable Care Act. because of that, you're going to have more people in the individual market as employers, to the extent employers drop coverage. And you have a whole boomer population that is entering Medicare now. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of Medigap coverage, the Affordable Care Act doesn't really apply. It doesn't regulate Medigap. So that's going to be an important feature of the healthcare market going forward.
Peter Luke, Bridge Magazine writer, thanks for talking with us today and providing the perspective on Stateside.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been called one of the most positive human stories in American history, the Underground Railroad, a series of safe routes and secret houses used by slaves to escape from the South to a new life in free states or in Canada. Michigan's role in this major piece of American history was significant, and its impact is a crucial part of who we are as our state. Dr. Roy Finkenbein is the interim dean for the College of Liberal Arts and Education at the University of Detroit Mercy. He's the professor and chair of the history department teaching African American and 19th century American history. And welcome, Dr. Finkenbein. Track Michigan's role in the Underground Railroad for us. When did the freedom seekers first begin making their way to Michigan, and why?
It really started to develop as Michigan developed after the War of 1812. The infamous Erie Canal opened this area to movement between east and west, and so you got a lot of folks coming from New England, upstate New York, into the area, as well as Quakers who were coming into southern Michigan, having made themselves persona non grata in the South because of their stance against slavery, as well as an increasing number of slaves and free blacks coming from the South because of the development of the cotton kingdom further westward and tobacco agriculture and so forth further westward in places like Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yeah, we have to remember once upon a time, way west was Kentucky.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So how many years would we say the Underground Railroad was in operation, and when was the peak?
It's really a going concern in this area for about 50 years. Obviously, the history of the Underground Railroad stretches back further in the eastern United States. It becomes a reality once Pennsylvania in 1780, near the end of the Revolution, decides to start phasing out slavery. And so it becomes a free state, and slaves from places like Virginia and Maryland have somewhere to run to. And the North now is viewed as a place of freedom, and the South is a place of slavery.
So here is Michigan. It is a free state. And geographically, it probably couldn't be more perfect for freedom seekers. How so?
Well, it is just uniquely located across from Ontario, and as a kind of a key location for slaves running northward with help from a lot of places. And slaves running, you know, northwestward across Ohio and come up through Detroit. And so this long river border between Ontario and Michigan becomes just an ideal location for people wanting to cross into freedom in Canada.
And the impact on Michigan, it wasn't just the Detroit area, was it? Because they were coming up the west side of Michigan as well involved?
Mm-hmm. The west side's very involved. You see a series of networks from Niles and Cassopolis in the west. In fact, we forget that in the period before the Civil War, there are as many African Americans living in Cass County in the southwestern part of the state as there are in Detroit.
I was so surprised to read about the large anti-slavery demonstration in Battle Creek. That was 1847.
Very
forward thinking.
Absolutely. There was a man named Erastus Hussey who, if you go to Battle Creek today and see the large Underground Railroad memorial in one of the parks there in Battle Creek, he is the fellow that's helping the fugitive slaves. And it says something about Michigan that while we think of the Underground Railroad as always and ever secret, mm-hmm. hidden, there are times because of the attitude of people in the community and because of the fact that Michigan is so far north from the Ohio River and from slave catchers that at many times you could feel relatively safe being a little more public. It will be more accepted by the community. And he walks several dozen fugitive slaves through, you know, eastward through Battle Creek on the way to Detroit in the noonday sun, and he's not challenged.
He is not
challenged. He's not arrested.
So that was significant because it was so open. Mm-hmm. But give us a sense of what it was like for a freedom seeker making that journey. Was it generally at night? What was life like if you were coming up, let's say, from Kentucky and you mm-hmm. were trying to make your way to Windsor? What would your days and nights be like?
Most runaway slaves didn't get much assistance until they got across the Ohio River if they were coming from the south. There wasn't anything like we'd think of as an organized network in most parts of the south. Now, it still has to be very, very secret. The so-called borderland between freedom and slavery means that those that are involved face danger from angry slaveholders who might shoot at them, might commit acts of violence against them. And as the law is toughened up in 1850, the federal law against fugitive slaves and assistance of fugitive slaves, you can do a major jail time and be fined a significant amount of money. So slaves coming northward are operating in secret. That doesn't mean they're not frequently assisted by people who are quite ingenious. There's a story of Levi Coffin, who is a Quaker that operates out of Cincinnati, and at one point he puts together a funeral entourage and intersperses fugitive slaves among what seems to be a black funeral entourage proceeding from Cincinnati to Dayton as a way of getting them down the road in a hidden way. But while we can't make universals of this, you know, the lights in the window, the hidden panels in buckboard wagons, and all of those things are true at different times and places. The further north you get, the little more open you can be. But even there are points, certainly, when slave catchers make it into southern Michigan. For much of the history of Detroit, particularly before 1850, you see slaves being brought into Detroit in the dead of night, hidden in locations in the city, including Second Baptist Church and the Black Masonic Lodge on Jefferson Street and other places. And then they would feed them, give them warmer clothing if they needed it, and the next night, then under cover of darkness, rowed them across the Detroit River to freedom.
And once they were in Canada, everything changed, didn't it?
Once they were in Canada, everything changed. In fact, Canada was very proud of its role as a haven for freedom for people from supposedly liberty-loving America. It's estimated that fully half or more of all blacks that end up in Canada before the Civil War come through the Detroit River corridor.
We're talking with Dr. Roy Finkenbein of University of Detroit Mercy, history professor, about the Underground Railroad. Take us up now to 2012 and give us a sense of context. What does all of that activity in the 19th century mean to us today in 2012 in Michigan?
I think it says a lot about who we are and who we want to be. You know, there were people, even in the midst of some pretty brutal conditions in slavery and in the struggle over slavery, who were willing to violate the law, quite frankly, and sometimes violate it openly and face the consequences because of what as they saw as the morality of the situation. And they did it in an interracial nature, whites working with blacks.
Mm-hmm.
It also speaks positively about the community in ways that sparked a lot of, I think, cultural tourism and historical interest. The Wright Museum received a large $600,000 grant from the Federal Department of Education to work on their Underground Railroad exhibit and the telling of the story. In November, the Detroit Historical Museum is going to open with a new series of permanent exhibits, one of which, The Doorway to Freedom, is going to tell Detroit's story in the Underground Railroad, and I think some very innovative and eye-catching in ways. And I think it's a great thing for the city of Detroit, potentially, and the state, in that I can see all sorts of cultural tourism. For example, black family reunion groups coming to Detroit and building part of their event around the history of the Underground Railroad in the Detroit-Ontario borderlands, particularly as these museum exhibits open and other things take place.
What lessons do you think that we in 2012 could learn from our forefathers in the 19th century who got so involved?
One is sometimes you have to put what's right above what's legal. I had a person in class maybe 3 or 4 years ago who was retired military who had lived in the San Diego area, and he caught me once after class and told me at some length about his work as a coyote helping to bring Mexican families that wanted to come northward over the California-Sonora border. And in his case, seeing this as something that was perfectly justifiable because of the fact that these people were, he thought, being denied their fair opportunity. I think perhaps the greatest lesson we can learn is that black and white, particularly in a city like Detroit, we don't have to let our historical enmities or differences, including geographic differences, get in the way, that we can find ways to work together for common good, for common solutions, and advance the future of our place, advance the future of our city, our region, and our state. And people today taking that chance can become the heroes that maybe people another century hence will look back on very positively. You don't have to be popular at the time. You can be popular 100 years later, and I think that's not a bad lesson.
A great lesson learned from history. Dr. Roy Finkenbein, University of Detroit Mercy, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
Still to come, those two words that continue to have Washington abuzz, fiscal cliff. We'll get a better understanding of what Michigan businesses are keeping an eye on as negotiations continue in D.C. That's in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you conjure up your image of a typical Republican member of Congress, having that representative signing up for cuts in defense spending might not come to mind. But amidst the fiscal cliff talks in Washington, there are a number of Republican voices calling for exactly that, cuts to America's defense budget. Among those voices is Congressman Dan Benischek of Crystal Falls. He is among 22 members of Congress who signed a letter to President Obama and party leaders urging them to include serious defense cuts in any fiscal cliff deal. And may we note, the 22 members who signed that letter, half are Democrats, half are Republicans. Representative Dan Benischek joins us now from Washington. Welcome, Congressman.
Well, thanks for having me on, Cynthia. How are you doing this afternoon?
Doing well. Well, I'll tell you, first, this letter, I have to tell you, I think people will be encouraged to see any proof that Democrats and Republicans can come to an agreement on anything. At least that's what it feels like out here. What led to this letter where you got together asking for defense cuts?
Well, I don't know, just common sense to me. I mean, we can't, as far as I'm concerned, eliminate one segment of the budget from the talks about the spending cuts. I mean, let's face it, we're spending $1 trillion more every year than we take in as a government. And it's, you know, making it very tough for our children and grandchildren to be able to survive being saddled with all that debt. So I think that every aspect of the government should have to be examined for cuts. You know, I want our nation to have a strong military and, you know, make sure that we're protected. But, I mean, there's a lot of waste. There's a lot of stuff that they spend money on that, come on, you know, we can cut every part of the government.
And you believe in the letter that you signed stated that defense spending can be cut without compromising national security?
Yeah, I mean, there's some things that we do that we don't have to do. I mean, I don't, for example, I don't know why we have military bases in Germany. I mean, what's the sense of that?
You're looking at things that you feel are entrenched from back in the Cold War and beyond.
Yeah.
So, in essence, with this letter, you and the other 21 who signed are saying the Pentagon budget is not a sacred cow.
Well, no, I don't think there's any sacred cows. I mean, that's, you know, I'm not a career politician. I'm just sort of a logical person that, you know, when you look at a $1 trillion deficit and $16 trillion in debt and you're worried about your grandchildren, and there should be nothing sacred. We should, you know, try to make studious, informed, but real, significant cuts because, you know, we can't go on the way we're doing it.
What kind of reaction have you gotten, if any, to the letter that you signed?
I don't know. I don't know that it's all that controversial myself. It came across my desk. It seemed like a logical thing to do, and, you know, I signed on to it. I was kind of surprised that, you know, you took notice, to tell you the truth.
I think it was even the fact that it was, like we noted, half Democrat, half Republican. Perhaps it's a sign to those of us who are not there on the Hill that, yes, there are things that both sides agree on, because...
Well, you know, I don't really care where the idea comes from. You know, I just want some solutions. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, you know, we need some solutions here. I mean, that's why I ran for Congress in the first place. You know, I never ran for anything before 2010 in my life. So, you know, when I ran in 2010, I was going, hey, listen, you know, I'm just worried about my kids and grandkids. We just can't keep spending money like this. And, you know, you might argue about the one policy or another or one spending program or another, but I think most Americans, Democrat and Republican, agree that you can't keep spending money you don't have. And right now, every dollar the government spends, they're borrowing 42 cents to do it. You can't do that in your home. I can't do that in my home. Pretty soon somebody comes and takes away all your stuff. That's what we're facing in America right now. And, you know, that's really why I ran for Congress, is to try to get some fiscal sanity.
We're speaking with Congressman Dan Benishek, Republican from Crystal Falls. And I would love to get your thoughts as an American who is right there on the front lines of this very historic moment with the fiscal cliff talks. And, you know, there's the line, this respective lines in the sand. And certainly to the public, it appears each side's entrenched and not giving in. Are these leaders on both sides?
I don't know exactly what to tell you. You know, I mean, all I know is that the president hasn't offered any spending cuts. I mean, he says, well, if we raise the taxes on, you know, somebody else, in other words, the rich, somebody that you don't know, that'll solve the problem. But in reality, the tax increases that the president has offered fund the government for 8 days and in no way affect the situation where it's going to improve, you know, balance the budget. It would take 500 years to balance the budget with these tax increases. Mm-hmm. So they have to be, if you're going to raise revenues, you have to actually cut spending. And what I don't like about this political argument stuff is he's out there saying the same thing, like it's going to solve the problem. It doesn't solve the problem at all.
Congressman, but I would like to ask for your thoughts, if I could. There was a new poll out about what basically America thinks of when it looks at Congress, and it appears, this is an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that you may have seen, that Republican Party approval ratings have dropped even lower since the election. So we've got 30% favorable, 45% unfavorable. But even more, when asked to give a short word or phrase to describe the GOP, 65% offered negative comments like uncompromising and bad and broken.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what the president is out there talking about. You know, I don't think that I've sounded completely unreasonable or mean, you know, on the phone here during this interview.
Sure.
I'm just trying to find a solution to the problem, and the solution has to include spending cuts. And I'm willing to look at stuff, but, you know, when the president says, well, you need to tax somebody else, in other words, the rich, and that's going to solve our problems, and I'm going to also include $50 billion more in stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
it doesn't do anything for me, you know what I mean? And I'm amazed that he gets away with it.
Congressman, what should we watch for in the days ahead?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that we'll come back next week and the leadership will have worked out a deal. You know, I wish this would just happen in regular order. In other words, in the House, we passed a legislation that averts the fiscal cliff already, but the Senate hasn't passed their own bill. All right, the Senate is dysfunctional. So, I mean, I don't expect them to pass the same budget that we passed. I expect them to pass their own budget or their own solution to the fiscal cliff. And then we'd work it out in front of the American people in committee by amendments on the floor and go to a conference between the Senate and the House and make laws in front of the American people. Unfortunately, the Senate refuses to do that. So we're left with, we've passed something, the Senate won't pass anything, to stalemate. And then the leadership has to do this stuff behind closed doors because the Senate, they don't want to vote on anything. You know, that's my frustration.
We can hear it. Congressman Dan Benishek, thanks so much for your time and talking with us today on Stateside.
Yeah, okay, Cynthia, it was a pleasure.
Okay, so the clock continues to tick as America moves closer to that fiscal cliff. The White House and congressional Republicans have yet to publicly budge from the lines each side have drawn in the sand. President Obama was in Redford earlier this week talking about the need for increased taxes on top earners to finance federal spending.
How many of you can afford to pay another $2,200 in taxes? Not you?
No.
No, I didn't think so. You can't afford to lose that money. That's a hit you can't afford to take. And by the way, that's not a good hit for businesses either. Because if Congress lets middle-class taxes go up, economists will tell you that means people will spend nearly $200 billion less than they otherwise would spend. All right, consumer spending is going to go down. That means you got less customers. Businesses get fewer profits. They hire fewer workers. You go in a downward spiral.
So we got to wondering, how is the uncertainty about the fiscal cliff affecting businesses in Michigan? Susan Tompor is the financial writer for the Detroit Free Press. Susan, do you see any signs that the fiscal cliff debate and uncertainty is causing business owners or managers in Michigan to back off on hiring or spending?
Well, they're certainly watching it. You know, back in November, we had Ford Executive Chairman Bill Ford Jr. State that this was vitally important, that they work on this bipartisan agreement for the economy. So when you're selling big-ticket items, it's a key issue. Will consumers need to cut back if we go over the fiscal cliff? Right now, according to Mark Zandi, he doesn't see in the big numbers in terms of jobs that companies are cutting back. And the reason is it would be costly to lay off workers now to prepare for what might be a temporary problem. Because even if we, you know, reach that December 31 deadline, there's always the thought that come January, you've got some wiggle room there. Instead, Mark Zandi from MoodysEconomy.com said overall, businesses are more likely to cut back on investing in computers, heavy equipment, maybe their advertising budgets as a stopgap measure. So this is just in case something happens. And you probably could see that with consumers a little bit, although I think, you know, right now this is a holiday season that's maybe people are still having jobs. You know, we're not hearing the big layoffs or anything in the headlines, and that's certainly good. But, you know, down the road, when I talked with Zandi, one of the funny things he said was, and I liked like this, everybody talks about the fiscal cliff, he calls it more like a bunny slope in the early part of January, meaning we don't just drop off. You know, if things don't hit the deadline, and that's probably what Washington is playing around with, right? They know that the economy really isn't going to fall off a cliff on January 1 if things don't reach an agreement. The problem is, as the calendar moves closer to February, business managers are going to start maybe pulling back a little bit more. They're going to be more fearful that policy leaders won't get it together. And, you know, when they talk about a recession, and most economists think that if, you know, we don't reach some sort of agreement, if you drag it out, maybe March, April, that's definitely recession territory. So, you know, we are in a tentative economy, if you will. But right now, there's this still thought that things would be reached, that some sort of an agreement would be reached. But doing nothing is and permanently going over the fiscal cliff. And again, most experts are not expecting that to happen, but it would be very costly when it comes to jobs. In Michigan, we're talking about perhaps 100,000, 110,000 jobs, or 2.6% of total employment in 2014 if we went off that fiscal cliff and, you know, no action was taken.
That's a big, big, big hit.
Huge. And the biggest hit, of course, would be manufacturing and government. But, of course, you'd also see cuts in leisure and hospitality companies. And perhaps even at some retailers, because disposable incomes would decline after tax hikes. And, of course, this is not just about, you know, where the taxes will be coming from. When you talk about the fiscal cliff, there's also cutbacks in federal spending that are triggered. And that's very important. About 2.4% of Michigan's gross domestic product depends on federal spending on procurement, salary, and wages. And that's according to a Pew Center on the States report. You know, we don't know how or what would be happening. You know, the flow down is very uncertain right now, how those cuts would actually hit the states. Yet it's clear that states would be vulnerable to some degree. It's not just a federal issue. It's not just a, you know, tax issue. It is a heavy issue in terms of where state money would be coming from. So this, you know, there's got to be some sort of an agreement, some sort of compromise.
Which at this point, when it's kind of like looking for smoke signals at the Sistine Chapel, and there hasn't been much sign of a willingness to compromise, at least publicly, it's hard to know what's going on behind the scenes.
It sure is, because publicly, of course, everybody wants to stay on, you know, task and stay on their position of, you know, cutting too much government spending, not raising taxes on the rich. I mean, that's pretty much where it boils down to the arguing, I think, some of it. You know, consumers are a big part of this, though, and, you know, if they start getting uncertain, you know, they're not dwelling on the fiscal cliff right now, but if they start getting a little more uncertain, things things might not go that great all along. You know, right now what we have going for us is that gas prices at the pump have fallen. Yay.
Yay. I think I actually saw 322 last night.
I
almost passed out. Wow.
Yeah. Think I saw 329, so you did better than me. Mm. You know, and the housing market's a little less frightening because homes are selling and some home prices have begun to rise. So those are two pretty big positives for the consumer. But, you know, back in August 2010, when we had this debate in terms of government finances, people did retrench, and it's not unusual for consumers to want to retrench. So it is going to depend on what the lawmakers decide to do. And you know, it's kind of crazy because you can even tweet on this. I don't know if folks have heard about that, but President Barack Obama said people could send tweets to Congress with hashtag #my2k. And that's a reference to the estimated tax increase on a middle-class family of four, you know, if the Bush tax cuts expire.
It does seem, though, from what you had said, that that term of the bunny slope. In fact, we actually heard MSU economics professor Charlie Ballard, when we talked with him a couple of weeks ago on this show, he called it more like a fiscal ramp than a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
So I what I'm hearing is that it isn't like the apocalypse happens at, 12:01 on January 1st.
Exactly. And I think the key on that is that if the talks continue, if people think that there will be an agreement reached, everybody knows Washington drags it out to the very end. We don't like it, mm-hmm. but we know that's how the game is played. But, you know, right now, Michigan's economy is expected to have a modest growth next year of about 2%, according to Moody's. So that's, you know, you want that growth. You don't want more pullback. It's not great, 2%, but it's not a recession.
Better than it's been.
Right. a fiscal cliff could lead to a serious recession in Michigan if this thing continued.
And we saw Michigan really almost lead the nation in falling into recession, hit harder and earlier. Do you think that would happen if we see a downward spiral in 2013?
You know, that's a very good question. From what I've been hearing from people is that they're saying that, you know, they don't think it's another meltdown of the economy. Back when we saw that meltdown, it was because of housing and it was because of the credit crunch. So it seems like people are not, you know, trying to bring that and say that that's, you know, the end of the world kind of scenario thing. So that would be helpful, that they're thinking that there is some potential even for stocks on the upside if a deal turns out to be better or sooner than expected. There's that potential there, too. And if the market, you know, continues to go up, then that helps consumers or investors in the long run. So right now I don't hear any economists saying, oh, we're headed down the road where we were in 2008, 2009. I haven't talked to anybody saying that. So that's a good thing. We don't want to go back to when people couldn't borrow money to buy cars or, you know, had so much difficulty with homes. Right now, people are sensing that, you know, there is some stability or more stability beginning in the housing market, which is certainly key to going forward.
Detroit Free Press financial writer Susan Tompor, thanks for your insights.
Oh, thanks very much.
And now, quickly, to the Great Lakes. We've talked before on Stateside about how the lake's water levels are lowering, shrinking because of drought and rising temperatures. Well, lower levels have meant things that have previously been hidden beneath the water are now showing up, including old shipwrecks. The Huron Daily Tribune reports a man spotted what he thought were rocks in Lake Huron, about 15 feet off the shoreline of Huron County's Lake Township. But when he got closer, he discovered it was the bow of a ship. The ship looks to be about 18 feet wide and 60 feet long. The name of the vessel so is still unknown. And earlier in the week, the Muskegon Chronicle reported the remains of a wooden steamer named Aurora were uncovered at Grand Haven near Lake Michigan. Meantime, Coast Guard Petty Officer Peter Brown is telling the Associated Press he expects more shipwrecks to turn up. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again Monday at 3:00.